Thank you, guys. So I was handed the title, Lessons from the Life of Jacob. And if you've read the book of Genesis lately, you'll realize that the life of Jacob covers about 700 chapters. And there's this book that Sean wrote about how when you preach or when you teach, you ought to have one main point. And so I'm trying to pull one point from 700 chapters from Genesis, or not 700, but a lot. And so it was really kind of a challenge for me to figure out what exactly do we, what one thing can we take from the life of Jacob? And so I kind of landed on something, but as any time you teach goes, there's a lot that we have to leave out, okay? And so I just want to admit that there's a lot of lessons from the life of Jacob, but I'm zooming in on kind of one thing that I think is a thread that we see through Jacob's life. And what I've decided to call this is few and evil days. Few and evil days. Well, that's a terrible title for Jacob. Do you think Jacob would want to say that about his own story? Well, actually, he did. This is a quote directly from Jacob toward the end of his life. He says, "Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life." That's a really interesting statement from one of the patriarchs. I mean, this is one of the pillars of our faith. I mean, he is a central character in the Bible, and when he describes his life, he says, "Few and evil are the days of the years of my life." And so I want to explore a little bit about his few and evil days. Now, I'm going to kind of rocket through a lot of the stories that we learned in Sunday school. Those are great stories to read, but I'm going to move through them really quickly, and we're going to see if we can cover most of his life. Now, Isaac, who, by the way, was Jacob's... It's okay to speak... Jacob's father. Now, Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. We're going to... Oh, I'm making mistakes already. I'm going to have to be quicker than this. Let's see. But the children struggled. Important word there. Remember that. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If all is well, why am I like this?" This is so much like a pregnant mother to assume that any sort of problem is their own fault. My wife has this thing that happens when she's pregnant. She was recently pregnant. And any sort of little hiccup, she's wondering, did I eat the wrong thing? Did I sit the wrong way? It seems that Jacob's mother's kind of thinking along these same lines. It's like, is there something wrong with me? Because it's like a wrestling match inside of my womb. And so she went and inquired of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb." Well, no wonder. There's not much room in there. There's nations inside there. "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body." This is like the first sonogram, by the way, because I don't know if she knew that she had twins, but God can see right into the womb, and he says, "Yeah, it's a boy. Oh, there's two. There's two boys in there, and they will be these nations. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." Now, right here, we have an identifier. What we have is a prophecy about whichever one comes out second is going to have sort of this priority spot, this prestige in a way. He's going to be the one who, I guess we could use the word, the one who will be served, okay? So Isaac and Abraham had this promise, this kind of heredity promise that was going through their family, and it was going to be passed to one of those sons, and now they have a really good idea on who it's going to be passed to. It's whichever one comes out second. And so now the second born has kind of this promise on his life, and this is a thing that they would recognize and very likely a thing that they would tell their children and talk about. And so as Jacob grows, what we see is that he fights for that favored position. We see it over and over, especially in his young life. And some of the examples of this, as you'll probably remember, are the time when Jacob is actually born, he's grasping at the heel of Esau. Now, I mean, maybe it's a little hasty to assign motives to an infant, but it is an interesting picture for the rest of his life, that he would struggle and he would wrestling as those around him to get this priority position. Another example of that shows up not long after in the narrative. It's interesting how you have to kind of bend to get this thing to work. Jacob cons his brother to be first. Now, if you read the commentaries, there's certain commentators that would kind of twist this into like a spiritual lesson, but I think he's just being, a con man. I think he's just, literally conning his brother out of the birthright. Now, think about what's going on here. Jacob is born second. He's the second born, but he kind of has this concept that he is supposed to have this priority position. I think he's just helping God out. I think he's just sort of trying to make it work along the way that he believes God ought to make it work. He's trying to get what he thinks should be his to come to him. And so he cons his brother out of the birthright for a bowl of soup. And what it looks like when you read the story just at face value is that he takes advantage of his brother at a moment of weakness. His brother is exhausted from hunting the game, and he takes advantage of him. Now, I know there are those out there that turn it into a spiritual lesson, but that's what it looks like to me. Is that he is fulfilling that statement which he mentioned, that his days were a bit evil. Here's another one that we see not long after this in the narrative. I might just pass this back and somebody click it for me. This is going to be a consistent thing. Jacob swindles his brother and his dad to be blessed. Interesting thing about this one is that it's actually his mother's idea in the first place. His mother kind of presents this idea. She hears his dad and his older brother kind of having this conversation about how Isaac's going to give this blessing. And Rebecca kind of swoops in and says, okay, here's what we're going to do. And in this moment, Jacob even kind of resists and says, I think dad may be able to tell which brother I am because my brother is as hairy as a fur rug and I'm not. So they devise this plan and he goes along with it and he cons his father. Now, again, you'll see commentators that kind of turn this into like a spiritual thing. He's doing it out of faith because he believes it. But he literally lies to his dad. I mean, there is just straight deception because at some point in the conversation, Isaac says, you are Esau, right? And he just literally lies. And so I just can't see a situation where God is leading Jacob to lie to his dad about his own identity. And so to me, I think once again, we see that theme where Jacob is demonstrating what we would just call deception and call evil. He is trying to jockey for this position. He's trying to work for this position that, by the way, he's already been prophesied that he's going to hold this position. So, not long after this, he has to leave town. He has to get out of town pretty quick because Esau says, you know what, I think I'm going to kill him. And he doesn't mean it like kids say it. He means literally he's plotting. He says, you know, the days of my father's mourning are at hand, meaning I think dad may die soon, and I really probably shouldn't kill my brother like in that period of time while dad has just died because it would really bother mom. So I'll wait till Isaac is dead and gone, and then once Isaac's gone, then I'm gonna murder my brother. That's his plan. I mean, so his mother once again hears it. And she's like, oh, I don't like that plan. Let's make a different plan. And so then again, his mother kind of devises this slightly deceptive scheme where she goes to Isaac and says, hey, I can't stand the women here in Canaan. And Esau, you know, he married those Canaan women and that really bugs me. So I want to send Jacob back to Padan Aram and maybe he can find a wife there, kind of like you did, Isaac, because, you know, it feels very similar to him. And so Rebecca comes up with this idea to get Jacob out of town, basically to save his life, to get him out of town. And Jacob goes along with it. And so they present it to Isaac and Isaac, you know, it goes along with it and sends him on. Now, here's the reason, though, and I think we got to remember this. It sounds all very spiritual, but Jacob had to leave town because, this is the Bob-style dramatic moment, because Jacob was fighting for a favored position. He was working, he was laboring, he was deceiving so that he could have this favored position. And I think one of the things that we have to remember is that it came at great cost. I mean, he destroyed the relationship with his brother because he deceived him. He cheated him out of his birthright, and then he cheated him out of this blessing, and now the relationship with Esau is destroyed. Now, not destroyed beyond recovery that we'll see later, but it is destroyed at this point. I mean, just so you know, if you're not an expert on relationships, if your interlocutor is saying, I'm going to kill you, that means that you've failed in the relationship and you need to do some cleanup work. And so that's where Jacob is. Now, he's also really hurt the relationship with his dad because he's deceived his dad. His dad is very frustrated with him. And now he's got to leave the family that he loves, and even especially his mother who really loved him, he's got to separate from him because of his deception. Because he was fighting for this favored position. And it came at incredible cost to him. So,
He came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set, and he took one of the stones of that place and put it at his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep. So he's on his way to Padan Aram now. We don't really know if he's alone. It makes it sound like he's alone here, which would be really uncommon to travel alone in the ancient world. So it sounds like he's alone. He lays down with like a rock pillow, which is, you know, doesn't sound great. We stayed at the Red Roof Inn last night, and it was a little better than a rock. though, you know, while I'm trying to find this, we paid for a non-smoking room, but I think the room just quit smoking recently because I still kind of have the smell on me here. Okay, I think maybe I'm in the right spot. I don't know. We'll just go from here. Then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached the heaven, and there the angels of God ascended and descended on it. By the way, this feels really similar to John chapter 1. You remember when Jesus is talking to Nathanael, and he says, you believe because I said I saw you under a tree? Man, you'll see the angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Now, I think that's important because we get to find out who is kind of at the top of this ladder in this next verse. I'm going to throw the signal back there. And behold, the Lord stood above it. So that's what I'm thinking is when we see the Lord here in Jacob's story, I think that we're seeing the person of Jesus before he is incarnate. And so I think we're seeing the pre-incarnate or pre-carnate person of Jesus Christ up on the top of this very interesting ladder. I wish I had a ladder like this. And this is what he says. I am the Lord God of Abraham and your father and the God of Isaac. I'm sorry, Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants. Also, your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north and the south. And in you and in your seed, important word, as we've talked about already, your seed, all the families of the earth shall be, shall be probably blessed, right? Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. Now, here's what I want to ask you about this, because we've probably all read this. What's the catch? Now, if you go back and read that passage, no conditional statement. This is just God saying, this is what I'm going to do. I've already decided, you know, I mean, it's basically because I really liked Abraham and I chose Isaac also, and now you're the chosen one. He doesn't give a conditional statement. He doesn't say you have to do this, 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 and this, and then I will bless you, I will give you this increase. He just says, memo, you know, note, and I'm just going to give you a notice. You're the one I've chosen. I'm going to make sure that you expand and you know, all of that. So there's no real catch here, at least not in this paragraph that we see. We don't see any conditional statement. So this is what I would say is God is offering his favor. By the way, a New Testament word for favor, we would probably call this grace. He's offering his favor for free to Jacob. So his favor is extended for free to Jacob. Now, that's a pretty important point. That he's not saying you only get this favored position if you do a certain list of, you know, what we might call good works. Instead, he's saying, I'm just decided. This is what's going to happen. Now, when we compare that against what Jacob's been doing, we begin to wonder, why was Jacob working so hard for something that God was offering him for free? So he had been fighting for the favor that God had offered for free. I like alliteration, and there's a lot of F's in that. He had been fighting for the favor that God had offered for free. Now, this is one of the reasons I picked this theme, because this is a free grace conference, and this is what our world is fighting. That God is offering something for free, and people insist on working for it. And I think Jacob had a bit of that in him. I think Jacob had that desire to add to assurance, which is a ridiculous idea if you understand what assurance is, but he wanted extra assurances that God was really going to do what he said. And actually, we see it in how Jacob responds. So Jacob, in a way, kind of bargains. Notice what Jacob says. And by the way, I mean, he's just seen this vision. Now he's waking up from it. And this, we're going to get his own kind of commentary on what he's just seen in this vision. Then Jacob woke up, and here's what then Jacob made a vow saying, and notice the two yellow. Do you get the yellow too? Yeah. Oh, you get yellow too. Cool. If and then. Now notice, this is an if then statement. This is Jacob responding to the vision he's seen with God. He says, if God will be with me, And by the way, it's interesting to me. He doesn't say if you, he's saying if God. It's almost like it's a third person kind of approach here. If God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on so that I come back to my Father's house in peace, then the Lord will be my God. Now imagine if this was the modern sinner's prayer that we hear in churches. I mean, look how many things he's including in his end of the bargain. He's saying, God, here's what I want you to do. I want you to make sure I come back in peace. I want to make sure that my belly's full. Basically he's saying the kinds of things that God already promised to just do for him. He's saying, yeah, if you do that, then the Lord shall be my God. Now, I really don't know what to make of this other than it seems that Jacob is kind of saying, yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe so, but I still got a lot of work I got to do. I want to make sure that all of this is going to come true. And so what I see in this is a kind of a bargain, kind of him trying to build on the assurances that God gives. So what happens next is a series of very unique and interesting stories. He works for 7 years for the wrong girl. So apparently bargaining and deception runs in the family because Laban, his father-in-law, really pulls one over on him. It's hard to imagine how this happened, but he works 7 years for the wrong girl. And then in the same, after the week of their wedding, he then kind of bargains for the sister, which also is a very unique situation. I can't imagine the kind of environment that he's building for himself, but he now is married to two sisters. And so he works for another 7 years. And by the way, nothing wrong with that. I mean, I don't want it to sound like I'm bashing good hard work. He does also seem like a really hard worker. He works really hard for all these things. And then there is this very unique, very interesting competitive childbearing tournament. Now, let me see if I can get this right, because it's a little bit of a brain twister. But Leah has four sons first. It's Reuben, Simeon, and then Levi and Judah. And then Rachel, who is currently barren but not going to always be barren, decides that in a competition, she's going to offer her maidservant, Bilhah, to Jacob, which Jacob seems all for, weirdly, but he's like, okay. And so then Bilhah has two, and I want to say, now let me not do the names because that's going to take us 40 minutes. So she has two, and then they bounce it back, and Leah's like, oh, you two can play that game. And so she then offers Zilpah, her maidservant, and she has two. And then to add insult to injury, Leah has two more. And then finally, at the very end, Rachel has Joseph. And then at the very end of her life, which is a few years later, she has Benjamin. And so what's interesting about this exchange is now Jacob's kind of approach to struggling and wrestling and fighting for the priority position, it spread to his wives. Literally in the narrative, what we have is Leah, she has this little commentary after each baby she has, and it's things like, now my husband will love me. Now my husband will stay with me. Now God has finally given me favor, and things like this. And so we see the same mentality spreading not only from Jacob, but to his circle of influence. And so it's very competitive. Now, after they have, I guess they'd have 11 at this point, they'd have 11 kids, Jacob does a selective breeding program among the flocks. And so basically what it is he feels like it's time for him to go home. He arranges with Laban, his father-in-law, for his payment now, because his payment for the first 14 years was two sisters as his wife. And now he is going to get payment from the flocks, which he's going to get the speckled and the striped and all of the younglings, the sheep and the goats, and all the younglings who are brown. And so it seems that you'd have no control over that, right? It seems like you'd have no control, but he tries to take control by cutting these wooden things and making stripes in them and putting them in the feeding troughs. I really don't understand what he's doing here. I don't get it, other than he seems to believe that it will result in there being more of the kind of flock that he gets to keep. And it does. And that's what's so strange about it. But here's an interesting thing in my mind, that it seems that behind the scenes, invisibly, God is blessing him. But he's doing something that he can take credit for at the same time. And so God's blessing and increase is happening, but he's over here whittling sticks and saying, see, look how this is really working. And so he's sort of like taking credit in a way for what God is actually doing. And once again, by the way, I think this is something we see in our world. You know, when people talk about grace, it feels like really often it's like, well, you know, yeah, God gave us grace and it's by faith alone, but, you know, I got to do my part too. And, you know, maybe I'm stretching the analogy here, but it feels like that same mentality that God's favor was promised to Jacob, but he still is like insistent that he's going to work for it. He's going to make it happen. He's going to do these things that we don't really even understand, but to him, they sort of make sense. And so ultimately, the end of it is he gains a huge amount of the flock. And by the way, he's like a millionaire now. I mean, multimillionaire in the amount of flock he has, and his family is huge. And now it's time for him to go home. And so he could go home honorably. He could go home as a nobleman, as even like a pseudo king. I mean, he is very wealthy, but the way that he goes home is kind of disreputable. So then the Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you." So him going home is the right thing to do, but I actually think the way that he goes home is a little questionable. So basically what happens is the words actually are used, literally, he steals away. Now, the loot is not in the Bible, but he steals away with the things that are rightfully his. I mean, he's made this deal, and now he can leave with these things. It's a legitimate, you know, it's legitimately his. But then also, Rachel steals the household gods, and she hides them in her saddlebags, and it's an interesting kind of exchange. And so, but they leave quietly. And now, once again, this is going to damage the relationship. Not, I mean, he's damaged the relationship with everybody back home. Now he's about to blow up the relationships with the family of his wives. And so he steals away, and he struggles with his father-in-law. And there's this really interesting exchange where his father-in-law, Laban, comes with men who probably know how to do some hurt, and they show up, and he comes, and it seems like his purpose is to come and hurt Jacob. But God speaks to Laban and says, "Hey, don't say anything good, but don't say anything bad to Jacob." And so they meet up, and it's sort of like now Jacob is being protected by God's word that came to Laban. And so it's almost like God is constantly cleaning up the mess that Jacob is making. And so because we're a little low on time, I'm gonna move past this. But this is Jacob kind of having this interaction with Laban, and in it, he sort of takes credit. Let me read that last little line there. He says, "God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you." Now, what's the labor of his hands? Well, part of it is that interesting selective breeding program, which God had to be doing. I mean, Jacob had no real, you know, hand in that. And so basically what he's saying is, yeah, God is providing for me, but I'm doing my part too. And so we see this kind of attitude still in Jacob. He hasn't really been broken of this yet, in my opinion. So what happens next is a contested border. They set up this thing where he says, "Laban, you don't come past this, and I won't come past that." My kids do this all the time, so it just runs in the human family, I guess. It's like, you know, don't, you know, this is our border, you stay on your side. And they literally do that with like a rock, and Laban's not supposed to come past, and Jacob's not supposed to go past. And what I see in that is the relationship is wrecked. Saying, "I won't go on your land, you don't come on my land." And so he leaves Padan Aram now with the same kind of way that he left his home, with people mad at him. Some of them have been thinking about killing him. I mean, it is a wreck the way that he is leaving the relationships in his life. So Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. Don't know what to make of it. They just met him, and it doesn't say much more, but it does remind us that God is with him. God is fulfilling his promise. And then he does what I call a parade of presents. He takes his flock, and at this moment, we realize how incredibly rich Jacob has gotten. He's got hundreds of all of it, camels and sheep and goats and whatever other kind of furry things that you can have hundreds of. And he puts them into groups, and he starts sending them towards Esau because he knows that Esau is coming toward him with 400 men. So he sends this parade of presents. And once again, rather than just saying, "God, I'm sure you've got it. I'm sure that it'll be okay because you promised me," he is still sort of scheming and struggling and wrestling, trying to make it all fit together. So he sends this parade of presents. And then he finally calls in God's favor. And this is one of those first moments in his life where we actually see him start to break a little bit, start to admit God's role in his life. Then Jacob said, "O God, my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your father, and I will deal with you,' I am not worthy This is the first time we really kind of see this attitude in him. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have shown. I mean, he's been put to the breaking point now. And he literally thinks he might die this morning because Esau is coming his way. And so he begins to admit that that it's God's favor. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I've become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. And so here's what's interesting to me in this. He knows that he's been promised descendants. And now, I think for Jacob, he knows that he's dispensable now. I think he's probably pretty sure that God won't let the kids die. And so what he's going to do is he's going to surround himself by the mother and the children. And I assume maybe part of that is to sort of shore up his bets. That God, I don't think God's going to let these kids die because they're the promised children. And so he still is kind of scheming, even though he does admit that it's all God's doing. Oh, come on. I only have 3 minutes. Okay. So let me if I had a working clicker, I would just zoom through this because I want to get us to the end. Okay, so now he's about to cross over. He's thinking about all of this stuff. He's really tense, and one more. It's like I'm climbing a mountain here. Here we go. I'm gonna step over the peak. He took them, sent them over the brook, and sent them over what he had. You guys, I'm struggling with it. Okay, then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him. I tell you what, just click it when I get to the period or the question mark. Okay, then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now, you know the story. This is, again, I think this is Jesus pre-incarnate. Now, here's what I think is going on. I think Jacob just prayed. He just prayed to God and said, I need help. And then Jesus shows up, and Jacob attacks him. I think that's how it goes. It doesn't say that. It just says they started wrestling. But I think Jesus is like, you called. You know, and then they wrestle. And so I don't think Jesus threw the first blow. I think Jacob is so tense and he's so wound tight that he sees a figure in the dark approaching him. He's by himself now. There's a figure approaching in the dark. And I think Jacob, just it's his natural inclination to just defend himself. And so he attacks. And this is what I love about Jesus. Jesus, you can't pin him. I mean, he fights back. He doesn't just say, okay, you win. He fights back. Now, obviously, Jesus could take him because he knows all the moves. But he lets Jacob continue to wrestle because he has a lesson to teach him. Now, when he saw that he did, and by the way, capital he, so we're talking about God here. When he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. So here's what we find out about wrestling. It's going to cost you something. I mean, you can wrestle, and God loves you, but you can wrestle, and it's going to cost you something. And I think this is the lesson that he's giving him. Let's go to the next one. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. But Jacob said, I will not let you go until you bless me. Sound familiar? Kind of what happened with his father. So he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. Now, for me, what he's saying is, you have struggled all your life. I've been trying to show you favor. I've been trying to give you the things that I promised you, and you still struggle for it. Everybody you meet, you fight them. You're throwing punches everywhere you go. And it's interesting, he says, prevailed. But if we actually look at the language, most of the translators put it as prevailed. But the word also can mean endured. And I like that one. Because this is Jacob's story, man. He struggles and he keeps struggling and he keeps struggling. Sometimes the word actually means understood. You comprehended. And so I think the lesson that I'm grabbing from this is that Jacob fought for a favored position at great cost, at great personal cost. But then also, he fought for the favor that God had offered for free. I mean, even in this moment, he's still fighting for God to bless him. And I think God showed up to bless him. And he still felt like, I got to fight him. I just got to fight him. It's what I do. And so he blessed him there. And I think this is the amazing, generous grace of God, that even for those who get into this mindset, he's still willing to do what he's promised to do. So I want to skip to the very end, because there's this amazing, I'm just like out of time. And this never happens to me because I talk so quickly. But we get to the very end, and this is just a verse or two, so I just want to read this because it's so interesting to me. Then Joseph brought, Jacob's an old man. He's ancient. He's 135 years old. And they've gone through the Joseph story and the brothers who just turned out to be murderers. They're rotten dudes, a lot of them. Some of them are okay. But a lot of them are just rotten. And so he goes through years of trial. Now he's an old man. They're in Egypt because of the drought and all those stories that probably someone else will cover. And now Joseph decides to bring him in front of Pharaoh. And this is such an interesting thing, because you got Jacob in front of the king of the empire at the time, the king of the world. Then Joseph brought him and he blessed him. Let me go back to that one. And he brought him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed him. And then notice what Pharaoh says. Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How old are you?" And so what it seems to be saying is that he is older than the people that Pharaoh was used to seeing. He was very old. Now I gotta finish, because I just got the stop thing. And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 35. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life." Now you're thinking, how could he say that's few? Well, he's comparing himself against his more faithful father and grandfather. "And they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." Abraham, 175 years. Isaac, 180 years. And so what I think he's saying here is that God gave me his favor, but I struggled. I fought. And by the way, it cut my life a little bit short. Now, he's going to live another 16 years after this, but his life is shorter. And so, the final lesson, Sean is moving towards the stage. I see him. He's coming. His days were few and evil because he fought for the favor that God had offered for free. It always hurts us when we fight for what God is trying to offer us for free. If we fight for what God offers us for free in a salvation sense without believing but just trying to work for it, we miss it completely. Once we become believers and have eternal life, if we continue to, as Paul said, try to justify ourselves by law, by works, it hurts us. It estranges us from Christ. That's all my time. Thank you, guys.